Hello and welcome to this podcast focusing on closing clinical practice gaps in hepatobiliary cancer with emerging immunotherapies and delivery innovations. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Ghassan Abu Alpha, Riyad Salem, Rachna Shroff, and Arndt Vogel will discuss the latest treatment strategies for hepatocellular carcinoma and biliary tract cancer, including new data on combining loco-regional therapies with immunotherapy and what it means for clinical practice. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals. In the first segment, Dr. Salem reviews the latest clinical trial data on combining loco-regional and systemic therapies for intermediate-stage hepatocellular carcinoma.
I'm going to go relatively fast and sort of share with you my perspective on intermediate-stage HCC, how I think about it from an interventional oncologist perspective. Really, we're in the U.S., so really look at TACE and TARE and how it fits in the immunotherapy, and really look at a few unanswered questions and areas of an unmet need that I really believe are there. And so, in general, when we talk about HCC, we use the BCLC algorithm. As you know, the top end gives you baseline characteristics to the best of the ability. We then line up the best level, best evidence data that we have for what the treatment recommendation should be. And now there's the cues, the independent sort of personalized decision making at tumor board. And of course, at tumor board, there are many things that we take into consideration when dealing HCC. One of the important ones is the intent. Is this a curative intent? Is this a downstaging intent, which really now is spanning many stages of HCC, or is it sort of a palliative? We have to look at performance status and other comorbidities. We don't have that many tumor biomarkers in HCC. We have AFP. We may have imaging that I'll try to convince you of. And of course, you amalgamate all of this stuff, and you make a decision when it comes to how to treat the patient. And so when you look at the spanning between sort of the BCLC-B all the way to the C, there really is an overlap as to where local regional therapy ends, systemic therapy starts, in both directions. Because I think when you think about managing the patient in tumor board, there are many places where, in fact, these things may, in fact, overlap. No discussion is complete without sort of talking about the top two clinical trials. We've already talked about EMERALD-1. We alluded to it, adding to TACE, Durva-Bev, or just placebo with a PFS endpoint, looking at key secondary outcomes, but really looking at where these types of therapies fit in mostly the intermediate patient population. Take note of who the patients included in those clinical trials are in terms of embolization eligible, in terms of not amenable for curative therapy. This will come into play a little bit later on. I appreciate very much the EMERALD-1 design because, in general, it held the Avastin until week 16. And as an interventional radiologist, this is where all of my technical adverse events arise, where I injure vessels, I spasm vessels, is patients on heavy exposure to Bev. So here, the patients got Durva in the first two arms and placebo in the third, but we were able to do our embolization work, and then the patients received the Bev after that. In general, when you look at the results, most patients got two treatments or less. Some got three, some got four, but in general, most got less. And if you look at the results, the positive results, those with that received Durva, Bev, and TACE versus placebo and TACE improved overall PFS, doubled overall PFS from 8.2 to 15 months. This is a meaningful observation for me as an interventional radiologist, and we can talk about that a little bit later on. Response rate is an important endpoint, and tonight I'm going to try to highlight and contextualize response rate a little bit more for you in terms of where this fits in. And so in the patient population that had Durva, Bev plus TACE, the response rate improved about 30-40%, from 30 to about 44%. That's a pretty meaningful response rate improvement. The other clinical trial, of course, is LEAP-12, adding len-pem or placebo to TACE. Again, notice the key eligibility criteria. All lesions had to be treated with one or two sessions. Child-Pugh-A, of course, measurable disease, and not amenable to curative therapy. So again, this is going to come in a little bit later on. And if you look at these results, again, also a significant improvement in PFS from 10 to about 15 months. So again, curves diverge very quickly after the first scan. They remain separate, and we see sort of a meaningful difference there. But did not hit the overall survival endpoint, as you can see here, that was reported previously. Response rate also improved a fair percentage from 33 to about 47%. So again, meaningful improvement of overall response rate. And I'll explain in a few minutes why that's important to me as an interventional radiologist. Now, these are the two papers that were published on EMERALD and LEAP. And if you look at the baseline characteristics, for me, the most important aspect, or one of the most important parts of any HCC manuscript, is the baseline characteristics table. Who are these patients? What size are the tumors? What's their liver function? What is their stage? And it's very important, and you can see from these tables, there's a lot of good information, but there's a little piece of information there that is lacking, and that is tumor burden and the imaging biomarker component. If you look at tumor burden, they have a tumor score, and they have a tumor burden score. So I'll talk about that a little bit later on. This is critical in HCC to better identify that. So in a moment of boredom on a Sunday, in my attempt to try to reverse engineer the patients that were included in EMERALD and LEAP, I put together sort of a series of 18 HCC patients that I saw that year in terms of what they look like, and I try to see whether they would meet the inclusion criteria for those trials. So the first one is ablatable, so no. The next one is 5 centimeters or more. Can't ablate that. That's a yes. The next one has PVT. You can't do that. PVT as well. You can't do that. Multifocal bilobar disease. I can't chemoembolize those in two sessions and treat all the disease. That's a no. Next one's a huge tumor. No way I can do that in one or two sessions. Next one I can do. Next one has ill-defined borders. Can barely measure it with PVT. Next one I can do. No problem in the trial. Multifocal bilobar disease. PVT. PVT. Solitary tumor. Ablatable lesion, that disappears. Infiltrative tumor, that disappears. And multifocal bilobar disease. So here we are. Out of 18 different scenarios, only 6 of them, by imaging, fit the criteria. And now I have to include Child, Pew, Albee, and everything else that goes into clinical trial decision making, which means that all of these cases here where we're dying to use combo therapies are the ones that were not in the clinical trial. So I caution you in your tumor board to really make sure that you recognize sort of what patients were in, what patients were not in. And so we've done a lot of work, and as an interventional radiologist, I always think about how do we sequence this? Is it the IO first and the LRT first? And so we think a lot about that. And so we're trying to, you know, do the best for our patients. And I put this slide in because if you're lucky enough to have seen either the Loch Ness Monster, the Yeti, or the Abominable Snowman, that is really what we are chasing, this abscopal effect, right? We do this quite a bit. So that's okay if that's what you're chasing. And I'm lucky enough to say that, in fact, I have seen the Loch Ness Monster once, and that's in this case right here. This is a left lobe HCC, multifocal bilobar disease. You can see on the left-hand side, it's infiltrative anteriorly, causing a lot of pain. I treated this person's left lobe only with LRT, and all the lesions disappeared with barely any residual disease. So I'm lucky enough that, in fact, I have seen the Loch Ness Monster. There's a lot on the horizon, a lot of clinical trials. We have to incorporate that in the way that we manage patients with all these positive studies. And of course, looking very much forward to Monday, as Dr. Abu Alfa tells us the findings of EMERALD 3. But when we think about what we have currently in terms of clinical trials, what do we need to do? I don't think it's sufficient to pick any LRT, assume TACE and TARE are the same, or DEPTACE and CTACE are the same, and any IO, and just mix and match in a hodgepodge manner. I think sequencing and timing matters. Should we do an LRT first, take advantage of antigen release, or should we do the IO, change the TME, and then go on to LRT? And of course, incorporating biomarkers, and I hope to impart some ideas as to what biomarkers might work. The other thing is, of course, refining endpoints beyond OS. And so, you know, having been doing this for 25 years, I've been arguing about the value, the importance, of course, of OS, but the contextualization of OS as a clinical trial endpoint, and of course, using things like the digital twin and AI to best select patients.
In the next segment, Dr. Vogel examines the approved first-line immunotherapy regimens for advanced hepatocellular carcinoma and how to select among them for individual patients.
If you don't know how to treat, the easiest way is to look at guidelines and see what they recommend. And as you can see here, there are a couple of treatments that are recommended for advanced HCC, which is good because you have a lot of options. but it's also bad because you make it, you need to make a decision for one specific treatment, and sometimes it's really difficult to make a decision for one of the options we have. Just to mention the three that I will also discuss in my talk a little bit more in detail, Atezo-Bev was the first positive trial, Dovotremi the second one, and the last trial we have seen Ipi/Nivo. There are more trials, but they have not been approved in the West, so they are not included here into the algorithms. Of course, we should try to do better, which means we should try to include patients into clinical trials, and we also need to think and consider local therapies also in patients with advanced disease. So to make it a little bit more complicated, and also to highlight that it's really difficult to develop guidelines basically in HCC, we do have a lot of options available. And as you can see here in our latest update of the ESMO guideline, we highlight all the possible treatments in early, intermediate, and advanced stage. We do not have head-to-head comparisons, so it's really sometimes difficult to decide for one specific treatment, and it definitely depends a lot on local expertise. Looking a little bit to intermediate stage, also based what Riad has shown us, I mean, in this version of the guideline, we have included the combinations of TACE plus immunotherapies. I'm favoring that. There will be an update of the ESMO guideline, and I can tell you already today that the update will look differently. But I think it's really important, and a very important question also Ghassan asked, so what should we do now with these clinical trials? We have four positive phase three studies. We have chosen PFS as a primary endpoint up front. The trials are positive, and now we start discussions on overall survival. I think, and I fully agree, overall survival is important. But as Riad also said, in intermediate stage, maybe it's a little bit too early to really ask for an overall survival benefit, specifically when you power your study for progression-free survival. And I think since the trials are positive, we have a higher response rate, we have longer progression-free survival, these are valid options. And probably, I'm not sure whether we need to discuss so much whether PFS is the right endpoint. This is something for future trials. We need to decide now what should we do with these four positive studies, and should we just leave them alone and say, okay, it's good, nice, positive, but we don't do it because we don't have an overall survival benefit. I'm not sure that this would be the right way, and I think the combinations do have some value. The high response rates definitely offer us options for downsizing, downstaging, and this is something I also would like to highlight here in the guideline. We have this response-adapted treatment, which means once we start a specific treatment, it's not only about having at some point progressive disease, of course, but also we can achieve high responses, which are up to 70% with our combinations, which allow us downsizing to potentially curative treatment. And this is, I think, something that could really change the outcome for our patients, and something we need to do more, which requires two more board discussions and teamwork in the end. In terms of really advanced disease, which also applies to those patients in intermediate stage where we think local therapies are not meaningful, we do have all these options. They are all listed here. In addition to what I have mentioned before, we have also Camrevo, which is not yet available in the West. You can also consider monotherapies with Durvo or Tremi. We have positive data for that. I think one of the most important questions is, obviously, can we use the checkpoint inhibitor, yes or no? In 90% of our patients, I think we can, and then we can choose one of these options. In those where we can't, we always mention two, lenvatinib and sorafenib, but looking at all the efficacy data in the latest studies, I think lenvatinib is clearly the more effective drug, and I would favor lenvatinib as an alternative to checkpoint inhibitors. In the second-line setting, we only have evidence for tyrosine kinase inhibitors after progression on sorafenib. Since we don't treat with sorafenib anymore, it's kind of an evidence-free area, but I think all guidelines recommend sequential treatment, and we will see more on Monday. When we now look at the three approved treatment regimens, the first one, as mentioned, IMREV 150, Atezo-Bev versus sorafenib, all efficacy endpoint clearly improved, higher response rate, longer progression-free survival, longer overall survival, and the safety profile was clearly in favor for the combination therapies. I mean, for those that still use sorafenib in the early days, the diarrhea, fatigue, hand-foot skin reaction, that was really bad. And with Atezo-Bev, we really have a treatment that is very well tolerated in the majority of patients and plus we have the high efficacy. Same for STRIDE. STRIDE has shown superiority compared to sorafenib, durvalumab, non-inferiority to sorafenib. We have clearly higher response rate. The safety profile is also in favor of the checkpoint inhibitors. We do have more immune-related side effects when we add tremelimumab. So adding one dose of CTLA-4 not only increases efficacy, it also slightly increases toxicity, and we have a slightly higher use of steroids for immune-related side effects, 10% versus 20%. What I'm not showing here, but what I really would like to highlight, that Himalaya is one of the first studies where we can really report 3, 4, 5, 6 years survival data, which is really exciting. And I think this is the really big difference we are seeing today. It's not about the median and the PFS of 3 months, 4 months, whatsoever. It is we can report 5 years survival in HCC, and this is really exciting. And I think all of us who are treating HCC, we do see these patients in clinical practice, which we are really following for years and years and years, and that's really good. The last study that has been reported is a Nivo-Ipi with a higher dose of ipilimumab that adds toxicity. We do have more toxicity compared to more immune-related toxicity compared to atezobev and STRIDE. In up to 30% of patients, steroid were required, but it also has a lot of efficacy. Response rates are up to 40%. Progression-free survival is longer. Overall survival is longer. Duration of response is getting up to 30 months. So that's exciting. It's an effective treatment. I would like to highlight, if you use Nivo-Ipi in HCC, you can really induce an immune-mediated hepatitis, so I strongly recommend to monitor LFTs early on treatment, and there are many patients that require steroids to treat these immune-related side effects. This is basically a high-level summary of the data that I have just shown you, and you can see we do have a gradual increase in median overall survival. With sorafenib, it was less than 1 year. Now we are getting close to 4 years. Response rate was not existent with sorafenib in the initial study, around 2%. Now, as mentioned, we are going up to 40%, and also tolerability is clearly better. We do not have these typical tyrosine kinase inhibitor mediated side effects anymore, which means treatment is really better and well tolerated and certainly manageable with these IO-based combinations. Just one, just to mention here, when we put this all next to each other, it should not be cross-trial comparison. Of course, we do cross-trial comparison also because we need to make decisions. But one caveat is here, the IMbrave 150 study was the only study that included the so-called high-risk population, which up to 20% of patients, which include those with VB4, so main portal, vein infiltration, tumor burden, over 50%, and also bile duct infiltration. And as you can see here, this is clearly highly negative prognostic markers. Median overall survival is clearly shorter, clearly less than 1 year in this population, in this high-risk population. Importantly, however, you can see that the curves are separating in both cohorts with a similar hazard ratio. So albeit these patients have a very poor prognosis, treating them with atezobev, with checkpoint inhibitors, is clearly meaningful, and we do see a better outcome. Of course, if somebody has an VP4, very likely these patients have portal hypertension, which means they are at risk for varices, and with that, they are at risk for bleeding with bevacizumab. So if you treat VP4 patients with atezobev, you certainly should do an endoscopy before you start treatment to avoid really running into bleeding complications. And while I have said before that it's exciting that we can report 4 year, 5 year, 6 years survival rates with our immunotherapies, it's getting even better. We can now report recurrence-free survival. And when we report recurrence-free survival, means we have achieved a complete response. Yeah, and we can achieve now complete responses in patients with advanced HCC, with vascular infiltration, with extrahepatic spread, when we treat them with checkpoint inhibitors. And as we have done here in this analysis, which we published last year, the numbers are still low, no question. So we looked at almost 4,000 patients, and you can see 4.4% developed a complete response. So it's not big so far, right? But I think the door is opening, and now we need to open it further. But having and achieving complete responses is meaningful. Some of these patients are cured. And we have now interesting discussions. So how long should we treat with checkpoint inhibitors? Some of my patients do not develop any side effects. They don't want to stop there on treatment for 4 years. Yeah, so this is new discussions we are having now in clinical practice.
In the final segment, Dr. Schroff discusses the evolving role of immunotherapy in the treatment of biliary tract cancers, including real-world applications of current standards and emerging combination strategies.
So we are going to shift now to biliary tract malignancies and talk about really the focus being, of course, on immunotherapy. And, you know, we say all the time that biliary cancers were a little bit late to the game for immunotherapy, but now immunotherapy is clearly here to stay. These are the obviously two pivotal studies that really changed the landscape for the treatment of newly diagnosed biliary tract cancers, and that obviously includes cholangiocarcinoma as well as gallbladder cancers. The TOPAZ-1 study you'll see on the left, and that was the first study to be reported out. That was the study that looked at newly diagnosed biliary tract cancers randomized to gemcitabine cisplatin with durvalumab as a checkpoint inhibitor versus gemcis and placebo. In this study, as we just as a reminder, you receive 8 cycles of the gemcis, and there's a maintenance of the durvalumab versus a maintenance of placebo, and the primary endpoint of overall survival was met. And you can see we have, you know, the Kaplan-Meier curve down here with median OS just around, just a little over 12 months that has been reported with the gemcis Dorva. But again, as Dr. Vogel mentioned, I just want to point out that we now have landmark and follow-up data, landmark analyses of 36-month overall survival and 24-month overall survival that's noted on this curve. And just as he mentioned, you know, medians don't really tell the whole story when we think about immunotherapy, and you see this separation of the curve and the tail on the curve that we like to see that kind of indicates that staying power of the immunotherapy. Similarly, KEYNOTE-966, which read out shortly thereafter, very similarly designed study, slightly larger, just over 1,000 patients, but this was gemcis plus pembrolizumab versus gemcitabine and cisplatin. Here, the maintenance component after 6 months was gemcitabine with pembrolizumab, as opposed to just the pembrolizumab alone, as you know, in the TOPAZ-1 study with Durva. And again, very, you know, kind of consistent numbers in terms of median OS, just under 13 months, 12.7 months. And again, you see the landmark, the 12-month, the 24-month, and 36-month overall survival, perhaps not as clearly separated, but still a separation of the curves that we see at the 24-month landmark and 36. So, you know, I think that has been our benchmark, and that is what we're looking at. But I think as a testament to some really motivated investigators, there have been sequential studies, and I say all the time, I credit the TOPAZ investigators. You know, when TOPAZ first came out, they did a deep dive to really understand, are there subsets of patients that really benefit or are driving the benefit of durvalumab, and, you know, whether that be parts of the world that were enrolled, because this was a large global study with a hard, heavy enrollment from Asia or Asian race as well, certain tumor types, intrahepatic, extrahepatic, gallbladder, et cetera. So all of that turned out that it seemed, while not powered, that everybody really kind of benefited from the addition of a checkpoint inhibitor. So the next subsequent study was called the Tourmaline study, and this looked basically at patients with biliary tract cancers with a durvalumab backbone with any sort of gemcitabine-based chemotherapy, because in the real world, sometimes people are not getting just gemcis, right? And so this looked at a myriad of options in terms of single-agent gemcitabine, gemcis in more marginal performance status, if you will, ECOG PS2, gemcitabine with oxaliplatin, gemcitabine with carboplatin, gemcitabine with S1, which is used in the eastern parts of the world, and then gemcis nab-paclitaxel. And then again, the durvalumab maintenance arm was looked at. It was continued as per the TOPAZ indication. And so this was really trying to understand, you know, who these patients were and what the safety looked like. Could you mix and match the gemcitabine backbone? And so in this study, the median age was 68. It was just under 50% female, 43%. And the majority of patients were enrolled. 3/4 of the patients were enrolled from Asia. But importantly, there were some important subsets. So just 16.5% had an ECOG performance status of 2, which, again, in real world, we do see some of these patients. And you'll see that just about half had intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma and about a quarter gallbladder cancer, and then a smattering of the others. And again, majority metastatic, as you know, one would expect. But here, when you look at the adverse events in the safety analysis set, it's broken down by platinum doublet, platinum triplet, and then platinum as a whole, and then anybody who didn't get platinum. And across the board, you know, the grade 3-4 adverse events were relatively kind of predictable and steady, frankly. So, you know, in the platinum doublet, it was about 50% of patients who had any grade 3-4 adverse events within 6 months. And platinum triplet, surprisingly slightly less, 41%. But platinum as a whole, right at that 45, 46% benchmark. And again, even in patients without platinum. So kind of suggesting that perhaps the safety concerns that we had with switching out cis for oxali, switching out cis for S1, adding in, you know, nab-paclitaxel, in general, relatively comparable, even in doublet versus triplet therapies, and, you know, kind of reassuring that some of the things that we're doing in clinical practice were not necessarily things that were decreasing or increasing risks around safety. Importantly, when looking at overall response as kind of one of the surrogate endpoints for efficacy, you can also see here, again, broken down by overall response in blue, and then the pink is stable disease. And platinum doublet chemotherapy with the durvalumab was right around 29%. And again, you know, we saw just in that mid to high 20 range in the initial TOPAZ-1 data set. Stable disease was around 38%. And then you'll see kind of across the board what the rest of the numbers look like. Perhaps slightly higher disease control rate as a whole with the platinum triplet, which we had seen in some of the GemCis nab-paclitaxel data that had come out in the United States. But overall, relatively preserved numbers. So, you know, mid-20 range for overall response, regardless of what the gem-based backbone looks like, which again, reassuring that we're not hopefully trading out efficacy by using different alternatives to the GemCis. So let's just kind of talk through where we're at. And when we think about metastatic biliary tract cancers, obviously this is focusing on immunotherapy. So I'm not going to, I would need a whole separate talk for targeted therapies. So we're looking at patients and we're thinking about the world of kind of all comers. So before 2010, before anything, we had no standard of care, no randomized trials that showed benefit. Obviously, 2010 changed that game with the ABC-02 data with GemCis as the new standard of care, with the basic benchmark that we had of GemCis with a median overall survival of 11.7 months. Then you get to that immunotherapy era. So in 2022 and 2023, we see TOPAZ-1 and KEYNOTE-966 read out. And again, now we're seeing GemCis plus IO right around 12.7 to 12.9 months for median overall survival. And so now we're thinking about what this next generation looks like. What can we build on? Where can we move in terms of immunotherapy-based approaches in biliary tract malignancies? So we start with, you know, the traditional PD-1 or PD-L1 approaches, and now we've also sort of moved now into the concepts of these bispecifics, and these are dual checkpoint inhibitor bispecifics, two of which that are pretty robust in terms of the number of clinical trials that are ongoing are volrustomig and rilvegostomig. So Rilvi is a PD-1 TIGIT dual checkpoint inhibitor bispecific, and Volru is a PD-1 CTLA-4 bispecific that, again, you know, as you can imagine, are important in terms of continuing immune modulation in a number of malignancies. As I mentioned, we're looking at these things in GI malignancies, but these are in trials across solid tumors right now.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.